If you're visiting with us, you might not know what everyone else here knows, and that is that on the back of your bulletin, you'll find a sermon outline which will equip you to follow along as this morning we look at what the Lord commanded us to do in Mark chapter 12 when he said that all the commandments are summarized in this one commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. That's the text this morning, and this morning we will take a unique approach to it because this is a unique day in the calendar of the history of the Christian church. For it just so happens that on this very day, 300 years ago, that is October 5th, 1703, a young couple named Timothy and Esther welcomed into their family a brand new baby boy. And it was a very special occasion for them because although they had had four children already, they hadn't yet had a son. And their little boy that they named Jonathan was the first boy that was born to them. And they went on and had 11 children in total, and he continued to be the only boy. We're looking this morning at Jonathan Edwards. Because of his particular grasp of the knowledge of God, because of his view of God, and remembering and giving thanks to God for what his life can mean to anyone who will look to him as an example and a teacher. Now, as a personal matter, let me say that I've been looking to him as an example for 20 years, since 1983, when I first was told about this man, Jonathan Edwards, who was a preacher, a pastor in New England, in fact, Massachusetts. It's not surprising, perhaps, that Jonathan Edwards became a pastor because his father, Timothy Edwards, was a pastor, and his mother was a pastor's daughter, and his grandfather, of course, being a pastor, he actually went to work for him. First, he pastored for a couple of months in New York City, and then he worked alongside his grandfather, Solomon Stoddard, in the town of Northampton, Massachusetts, and then when his grandfather died, he took over the church, so to speak, and pastored there for more than 20 years. And he has, by his biographies and his journal and his writings, been to me a very powerful and helpful example because he was, in his time, a lot of things excellently that I mean to be as well as I can be. He was, on the one hand, an excellent husband and had a marriage that he described to his wife in what are now famous words among Jonathan Edwards people as an uncommon union. And it really was. And when he died at the young age of 54, his wife was deeply saddened by the loss of her very best friend and the love of her life. His marriage stayed sweet and powerful for all those years, and that is an example that's of tremendous value and interest to me. While he was a good husband, he was also an excellent father. He himself had 11 children, did a little better at an even score. He only had 8 daughters and 3 sons. Yeah, that's a large family. And marvelously, for all the years that he was raising them and busily pastoring a church, his children continued to love and honor him and not resent his church, but love the church and love his God and walk in his example all the years of their lives. And that, of course, is a very important and stirring example for me. Then besides that, he was a very good pastor, a physician of the soul, as pastors were sometimes called back in those days. And he was a powerful preacher of God's truth. That's what I want to talk to you about this morning. And he was a fabulously helpful writer to anyone who's willing to do the work of reading and trying to understand his writing. And he was a champion of the faith, a great defender of the faith. And so he has been of great interest and value to me and to many other pastors. But I don't speak to you today about him because he's good for pastors. I realize that that would be a minority value. But rather, what his view of God can do for people like you and me who love the church and mean to do what we can to make the church a more powerful and convincing exhibit of the truth of God to our world. Martin Lloyd-Jones is the preacher from the 20th century who connected me to Jonathan Edwards, and he says this, it's printed on your outline at the top. Martin Lloyd-Jones said this about Edwards, "I am tempted, perhaps foolishly, to compare the Puritans to the Alps." He had a very high view of the Puritans, and he said, "They're the Alps." And then Luther and Calvin to the Himalayas, and Jonathan Edwards to Mount Everest. He has always seemed to me to be the man most like the Apostle Paul. And it was Martin Lloyd-Jones who pointed me towards Jonathan Edwards. The person who's pointed a lot of people to Jonathan Edwards these days is a Baptist pastor from Minnesota called John Piper. He's written a lot of books under the heading Christian Hedonism. He's written books called about desiring God above all things. And Jonathan Edwards was his tutor and his teacher. And he says, I've printed this out for you as well, Jonathan Edwards is in a class by himself. In a book that Piper wrote recently called God's Passion for His Glory, he speaks to us of the need we have to be guided by Jonathan Edwards in his practically unique grasp of who and what God was. And the reason he says we should be particularly concerned about this view of God that Jonathan Edwards can give us is because of something he calls the hollowing out of evangelicalism. That's a blank to fill in. According to Piper, we should be interested in learning from Edwards because of the hollowing out of evangelicalism. This is what Piper says about what Jonathan Edwards can do for us. He quotes from two books, one by Oz Guinness called Fit Bodies, Fat Minds, Why Evangelicals Don't Think and What to Do About It, and a book by David Wells called Losing Our Virtue, Why the Church Must Recover His Moral Vision. So he's talking about Edwards, but he refers to Guinness and Wells, and this is what he says. Evangelicalism today, all right, the churches that believe that you must be born again by faith in Jesus Christ, evangelicalism today is basking briefly in the sunlight of hollow success. Evangelical industries of television and radio and publishing and music recordings, as well as hundreds of growing mega churches and some highly visible public figures and political movements, give an outward impression of vitality and strength. But both Wells and Guinness, in their own ways, have called attention to the hollowing out of evangelicalism from within. In other words, the strong timber of the tree of Christ's church has historically been the great doctrines of the Bible, God's glorious perfections, man's fallen nature, the wonders of redemptive history, the magnificent work of redemption in Christ, the saving and sanctifying work of grace in the soul, the great mission of the church in conflict with the world and the flesh and the devil, and the greatness of our hope of everlasting joy at God's right hand. These things once defined us and were the strong fiber and timber beneath the fragile leaves and fruit of our religious experiences. But this is the case less and less. And that is why the waving leaves of success and the sweet fruit of prosperity are not as auspicious to David Wells and Oz Guinness as they are to many. It is a hollow triumph. And the tree is getting weaker and weaker while the branches are waving in the sun. This hollowing out of the church that Piper talks about is very much like what J.I. Packer talks about when he says that Christianity in North America is 3,000 miles wide and half an inch deep. There is a superficiality to the success of the church in the world today, especially in this part of the world where believing is easy and cheap, that should concern us who love the Lord and love His church. And Piper says that Edwards can help us with this. And why should we be interested? Well, he goes on in this book, God's Passion for His Glory, which would serve as an excellent introduction to Jonathan Edwards by saying this. What is at stake in the doctrinal hollowing out of contemporary evangelicalism? Here's a blank to fill in. What is at stake is the loss of God. And with Him, the loss of His truth and beauty. And with the loss of divine truth and beauty, the loss of truly seeing God and savoring God. And if we lose the true knowledge of God and the true love of God, the seeing and savoring of God, then we lose our ability to reflect His truth and beauty in the world. And the world loses God. That is finally what is at stake. Well, here's the thing. To be a group of people who are sincerely committed to making known the greatness of God, being people who know that the way to win people to Christ is to show them by the lives we live and by how we love one another and by the work that we do together that God is a great, great God. And it would be a tragedy beyond all description to ignore and to lose the opportunity to know God when He is so great. When we mean to be that kind of church, then someone of intelligence standing up and saying, here's what you need to avoid becoming superficial and hollow in your grasp of God. Well, we would do well to pay attention. And I found over these two decades of reading from Edwards to a large extent as my main source of help in terms of printed help, that Edwards' grasp of God and his relationship to God is such that by paying attention to what he was, reading his biography and his memoirs and his journals, and listening to what he taught by reading his sermons and his treatises, we can have a substance to our knowledge of God. We can have a depth which really does help. So I want to show you something this morning on this 300, anniversary of Jonathan Edwards' birth, of what he shows us by his writings. And this will be an encouragement to some of you to do the hard work of looking into his works, which are all available, by the way, on the internet these days, and benefiting from his knowledge, his grasp, his view of God. So here are 4 points for us to consider this morning. Committed as we are to making known the greatness of God, we can look to the life and works of Edwards for help in grasping the truth that, number one, our great God is greatly to be feared. Now, the fear of God is a tough sell for some people, but Edwards can show us that it's entirely appropriate, as in fact the Bible shows us it's entirely appropriate if we're willing to take it for what it says. If there's one thing that Jonathan Edwards is remembered for, and he usually does very poorly in people's minds because of this one thing, it's a sermon he sometimes preached called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And there is this notion that he was some sort of wild-eyed kook because he had this notion that God was an angry God. Just a few years ago, in 1961, a poet named Phyllis McGinley made fun of Jonathan Edwards with this little poem, a poem that contains these two little stanzas. If they had been taught aright, small children carried bedwards would shudder lest they meet that night the God of Mr. Edwards, Abraham's God, the wrathful one, intolerant of error, not God the Father or the Son, but God the Holy Terror. Well, she's trying to be funny and saying that if we were to give our children the view of God that Jonathan Edwards had, we would do them great disservice, for we would be teaching them that God is intolerant and not the Father and the Son, but he's... Well, she gives it all away when she says, you know, Abraham's God. But Abraham knew God. Abraham has a real relationship with the real God and knew that alongside the other things about God that are true, there's this about God that he ought to be feared. Jonathan Edwards shows us that our great God is greatly to be feared. And it's totally unfair, I should say, to judge Edwards' life and the value of his writings by this one sermon, which he did preach more than once, to no great effect in his own church, interestingly, and then to great effect in a little town called Enfield, not far away from Northampton. But to judge him by this one sermon is as unfair as to judge the Apostle Paul by what he said to the Galatians about the Judaizers, those people who said that you couldn't really get right with God through Jesus Christ unless you were also circumcised, which was carrying forward an Old Testament ceremony into the gospel. And Paul the Apostle was deeply concerned about the element of works that was creeping into their idea of salvation by grace. So he spoke in the harshest terms about these people who were insisting on circumcision. He says in Galatians chapter 5, I would that those who are troubling you would even mutilate themselves. Some translations say, I wish they would go all the way and emasculate themselves. Well, it'd be totally unfair to say, oh yeah, Apostle Paul, he's a guy that wanted to take a knife and cut people's private parts off. I mean, that's what he said, but a little context would go a long way towards understanding that it was just one thing he said, and he had his reasons for saying it. It would be like criticizing Jesus as a harsh and intolerant teacher because of what he said to the Pharisees. Jesus spoke very harshly to the Pharisees, but they were hypocrites, and they were leading many people astray. So Jesus says, it's recorded in Matthew chapter 23, woe to you blind guides, you fools, you blind men who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. You hypocrites, you're like whitewashed tombs. On the outside you appear beautiful, but inside you're full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how shall you escape the sentence of hell? Jesus really said those words. We don't have to pretend he didn't. But neither should we try to summarize his whole life by these harsh words he said to his enemies. And we should not judge Jonathan Edwards by that one sermon alone. Besides that, it's by no means his most horrible sermon. If Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God does not get your attention, you could try another sermon of Edwards called Wicked Men of the Past Are Still in Hell. Or another even more blood-curdling sermon called The End of the Wicked Contemplated by the Righteous. It's true, he was a fire and brimstone kind of preacher. But that's because with all of his clear grasp of the scriptures, he actually did believe in hell. And he was not too weak to stand up in public and say so. And he was not too unsure of himself to go on record as believing that people who do not have Jesus as their Savior through their faith in him will die and go to hell. He was not too unloving to explain that very clearly and try to scare people into coming to terms with the eternal realities of hell and heaven. He really did believe there was a hell. And the Bible is really clear that God is to be feared. In the book of Proverbs, we read that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And that's by no means something that died out or was phased out when the Old Testament changed to the New Testament. Jesus himself says in Luke chapter 12, I say to you, my friends, don't be afraid of those who can kill the body and after that have no more that they can do. But I'll warn you whom to fear. Fear the one who, after he has killed, has authority to cast you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him. That's Jesus. And throughout the New Testament, we read the apostles talking about conducting ourselves with fear during our time of the stay upon the earth and working out our salvation with fear and trembling and perfecting holiness in the fear of God. And then it's all summarized in the book of Revelation where we read, great and marvelous are your works, O Lord God the Almighty. Righteous and true are your ways, you King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? We need to grasp and put into place the fear of the Lord, or we don't properly approach God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and Jonathan Edwards is something of an expert in helping people get their minds around that difficult and unhappy truth. But the fear of the Lord was only part of what he has to say. And in fact, it's as a part joined to the other part, equally dominant in his teaching, that helps us to really get the hang of the knowledge of God in a whole new way. So here's the second point. Committed as we are to making known the greatness of God, we can look to the life and works of Edwards for help in grasping the truth that, number two, our great God is greatly to be loved. It's his ability to fear God who he loves and to love the God that he fears that he serves as such a great teacher for us in and allows us to plow through the scriptures and not set aside a part that doesn't seem to fit. He fits them together. And loving God is a very important part of the knowledge of God and our response to God. It's a summary, according to Jesus, of the whole of the Bible when he tells us that the greatest commandment is to love the Lord our God with all our heart and with all our soul and with all our mind and with all our strength. And Edwards can advance our understanding of how to love God that way. Edwards' messages were often just loaded down with this privilege we have of loving God and the advantages of loving God wholeheartedly and with a whole soul. And he points out very helpfully that it's only the person who comes to love God above all other loves that is protected from all of the ways in which life can just tear a chunk out of you. Edwards had tremendous troubles in his life. All kinds of terrible things happened. It makes his biography very lively reading. But he remained, throughout all the trials and difficulties, not only a faithful man, loving God with his whole heart, but because of that, a joyful man. And he wrote in a sermon called God, the Best Portion of the Christian, how attached to the love of God is the joy in God. He says this, we may learn that whatever changes a godly man passes through, he is happy because God, who is unchangeable, is his chosen portion. Though he meet with temporal losses and be deprived of many, yea, of all his temporal enjoyments, yet God, whom he prefers before all, still remains and can't be lost. While he stays in this changeable, troublesome world, the godly person is happy because his chosen portion on which he builds as his main foundation for happiness is above the world and above all changes. And when he goes into another world, still he is happy, because that portion yet remains. Whatever he be deprived of through death, he cannot be deprived of his chief portion. His inheritance remains sure to him. So how great is the happiness of those who have chosen the fountain of all good, who prefer him before all things in heaven or on earth, and who can never be deprived of him to all eternity. Edwards shows us in many ways the great advantages as well as the great obligation to love God with all our heart and soul and mind and strength. And it's more in terms of how to love God than how to fear God that he can help us the most. So this brings us to the third point, which is really a sub-point of the second point. It's a way in which Edwards instructs us to love God. So here's the third point. We can look to the life and works of Edwards for help in grasping the truth that, number three, loving God with all our minds requires our very best understanding of God and the things of God. If we're going to love God as we should, we must have our minds fully engaged. We must work hard to understand as much about God as we can. And here again, Edwards instructs us very helpfully and in a very positive way. This is the cure or the preventative to a hollowing out. If we want to be solid and substantial people whose love for God is not a flighty, superficial thing, but a deep-rooted, solid thing that we need to understand, because understanding God is a part of loving God. It's loving God with our whole mind. And it ought not to be just pastors and Bible college teachers, he calls them divines, theologians, that are concerned about growing in their knowledge. It should be all of us. This is what Edwards says in a sermon called Christian Knowledge. Truths about God not only concern ministers, but are of infinite importance to all Christians. Truths about God are those things which relate to everyone's eternal salvation and happiness. The common people cannot say, let us leave these matters to ministers and theologians. Let them dispute them out among themselves as they can. They concern not us. For these things are of infinite importance to all of us. Those doctrines which relate to the essence and the characteristics of God concern all of us, as it is of infinite importance to all of us, as well as to ministers, to know what kind of being God is. For he is a being who has made us all, in whom we live and move and have our being. He is the Lord of all. He is the being to whom we are all accountable. He is the last purpose of our being, and he's the only fountain of our happiness. So there is no doctrine of divinity, whatever, which doth not one way or other concern the eternal interest of all of us, of every Christian. It is, many people know, very hard work to seek to understand the things of God, to do the hard work of putting together what seems to be contradictory truths and working them out until you can see how they are one truth from different perspectives and not contradictory truths that should just be left to the theologians to sort out. It's hard work, but Edwards can lead us into understanding the value of doing the hard work of seeking to understand God and the things of God. As John Piper says, raking is easy, but all you get is leaves. Digging is hard, but by digging you can get diamonds. And what diamond is more worthwhile than the diamond which is really coming to know and understand God? Edwards shows us that loving God with all our hearts requires, with all our minds, requires our very best understanding of God and the things of God. And the scriptures encourage us in this way. Paul the Apostle, writing to the Colossians, talks about the role that the understanding has in living the life that God calls us to live. He prayed for the Colossians that they would be filled with the knowledge of God's will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding so that they would walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. He says, I pray that your hearts may be encouraged, that knit together in love you will attain to all the wealth that comes from the full assurance of understanding, which results in a true knowledge of God's mystery, which is Christ himself, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So Edwards can be our guide in leading us into a deep understanding of God so that we love him with all our minds. And yeah, it is hard work. You can go to the website that I list there. You can start dabbling in the works of Edwards. You might be thrown off by how hard it is. But then just keep remembering, raking is easy and all you get is leaves. Digging is hard, but that's how you get diamonds. Edwards was a brilliant man, nothing less than a genius. In fact, as a kid, he toyed with the idea of becoming a scientist and only got lured away from an interest in science by his greater interest in God. And it would be one thing to look at him as this mighty intellect and say, yeah, we should apply our intellects to the knowledge of God. But it wasn't just his understanding of God. It wasn't just loving God with all his mind, which is so valuable to us. It's loving God with all his mind alongside what can be described as loving God with all his heart. So this is our fourth point. Committed as we are to making known the greatness of God, we can look to the life and works of Edwards for help in grasping the truth that number four, loving God with all our hearts, means we experience a sense of God and of divine things. He didn't only have an intellectual grasp, he sure did have that, but he had a sense, he had a taste of God. He had an experience with God. So he wasn't just in it academically because he was an academic. He was in it with his whole heart. He had a taste for God, and he writes about this. In fact, he writes about it most personally in his journals, which he quite clearly never meant any of us to be reading. So there's probably someone out there somewhere that we should be apologizing to for this. But here's what he said in his journals about his own spiritual experience and the growing taste or sense, that was his word, he had for God. He says, At that time, he means when he was a teenager, I began to have a new kind of apprehensions and ideas of Christ and the work of redemption and the glorious way of salvation by him. An inward sweet sense, there's his word, an inward sweet sense of these things at times came into my heart, and my soul was led away in pleasant views and contemplations of them, and my mind was greatly encouraged to spend my time in reading and meditating on Christ, on the beauty and excellency of his person, and the lovely way of salvation by free grace in him. This I know not how to express otherwise than by a calm, sweet abstraction of soul from all the concerns of this world. Sometimes a kind of vision, fixed ideas and imaginations, as if I was alone on the mountain or some solitary wilderness, far from all mankind, and sweetly conversing with Christ himself and wrapped and swallowed up in God. The sense I had of divine things would often of a sudden kindle up, as it were, a sweet burning in my heart, an ardor of soul that I know not how to express. This characterizes life as much as anything else, this sense of how sweet it is to know God. He manifested the sweet aroma of the knowledge of Christ by his life. And by reading what he says about this, we get some sort of sense of it ourselves and some sort of taste for it ourselves and perhaps some sort of sense that all this is still awaiting us. Interestingly, it was this very trait, this sense of divine things that he saw in his future wife that attracted him to her. And there's a great little love story, which is quirky in its own 18th century way. He was a 20-year-old theology student when he met Sarah Pierrepont, and she was only 13 years old at the time. And his biography says he had a great deal of studying to do, but the usually focused Edwards found that his mind was wandering. And in the front page of a Greek grammar book, this is what he wrote. He didn't write it for anyone else but himself, but he couldn't stop himself because he had met a girl. And he wrote, "They say there is a young lady in New Haven who is beloved of the Almighty Being who made and rules the world, and that there are certain seasons in which this great being, in some way or other invisible, comes to her and fills her mind with exceeding sweet delight, and that she hardly cares for anything except to meditate on him, that she expects after a while to be received up where he is, to be raised up out of the world and caught up into heaven, being assured that he loves her too well to let her remain at a distance from him always. There she is to dwell with him and to be ravished with his love and delight forever. Therefore, if you present all the world before her with the richest of its treasures, she disregards it and cares not for it and is unmindful of any pain or affliction. She has a strange sweetness in her mind and singular purity in her affections. She's most just and conscientious in all her actions, and you couldn't persuade her to do anything wrong or sinful if you gave her all the world, lest she should offend this great being. She is of a wonderful sweetness, calmness, and universal benevolence of mind, especially after those seasons in which this great God has manifested himself to her mind. She'll sometimes go from place to place singing sweetly and seems to be always of joy and pleasure, and no one knows for what. She loves to be alone and to wander in the fields and on the mountains and seems to have someone invisible always conversing with her." It's not a usual love story. Here's a 20-year-old who saw this girl, and she had something about her. It was the same thing, this sense of divine things. So he waited till she was 17 years old, and then he married her, and they lived happily ever after. It was the sense of the divine. It's this taste of what it's like to know God that, coupled with this mighty intellectual grasp of theology, sets Edwards apart as someone that we should learn from. So we who mean to make known the greatness of God should be interested in learning from and being guided by someone who had such a sense of the fear of God, but not a fear that caused him to love God less, and such a love for God, but not a love that caused him to fear God less, a great understanding of God, but not an understanding that turned him cold and academic, a sense of God which was spurred on by his understanding of God. I mean, here is a solid follower of Christ, and we, by learning from his example, can hope to be also, in our own little way, people whose fear of God and whose love of God and whose commitment to understanding the things of God and whose experience or sense of God shows the people that see us living our lives, the people who come to see how we love one another, the people who benefit from the work that we share as a church, come to see that God, in fact, is a great, great God. I would encourage you to take a stab at the works of Edwards. Start small and start meager and get a little taste, but grow in the knowledge that comes to you from someone like him. In his sermon on Christian knowledge, he gives a little 7-point formula for how we can grow in knowledge. I posted the whole section of the sermon on the church website, but here's the short summary. He says, here's what we need to be doing if we're going to grow in knowledge. He says, be really intense in your reading of the Bible. That's one. He says, don't content yourself with a cursory reading, but go below the surface and really seek to understand. That's number two. And then he says, number three, get a hold of and diligently use other books which may help you to grow in this knowledge. He had his list of other books that were a great help to him, and I have his works as the most helpful other books that have guided me into any sort of grasp of the scriptures that I could lay claim to. And then he goes on in point four, improve conversation, find people to talk to about these things. And number six, seek not to grow in knowledge for the applause of others, but for the benefit to your soul. And number six, seek God that he would direct you. And finally, number seven, put into practice what he shows you. So I've given the elaboration of those 7 points on the website, the church website. You can have a look there. But these are the things that we should be all about if we mean to be people who make known God's greatness. The worship team is going to come forward as I pray and lead us in singing songs that will prepare our hearts for communion. And as they do, let it be with a whole heart and with a whole soul, with all our mind, with all our strength, that we praise God and lift up our songs in adoration to him. And then as we take bread and the cup, we can proclaim together the Lord's death and be grateful that God has so worked in history that there is a way that we can know him through the work that Christ has done on our behalf. Let's pray together.